This is a great opportunity for us to talk about how both scientific research and news reporting can teach us different things and help us answer some different questions. And I think that's where we'll start tonight.
I would second Tammy. Thank you all for coming. I finished my master's degree this summer, and so I know how busy students are with work, and I know how busy everyone is with personal lives. So thank you for being here. I think this is a really great opportunity, and I'm very, very excited to see University of Delaware having this conversation. I think it's one that is needed on college campuses, but just also in our communities in general. And the same for you. It's very funny. I was going back through coverage and realized I interviewed you like 2 years ago. So the world is small. But I think in this conversation too, so is Delaware, which is all the more reason to have this conversation. Just to get everyone started, we have both kind of decided we would love questions as we go. If there are topics, if there are things that pop up, if you have questions, please ask. But I always think it's helpful to kind of start off the room with like what I call the great equalizer. And so if you're comfortable sharing, if you're comfortable raising your hand, I'm not asking anyone to get up and do jumping jacks. But how many of you have been prescribed an opioid painkiller for a procedure that you've had? Cool, my hand is up as well. How many of you took that opioid painkiller? Cool. And how many of you probably still have it in your home today? Okay. So my hand is up for all three, by the way. I always ask that because I think it's really important when we talk about the opioid epidemic, and I'm warning in advance, I tend to say opioid and heroin epidemic because one cannot be talked about without the other. But I think it's important because 80% of people who go on to use heroin will tell you that they started with a prescription opioid medication. And so I always think when talking about addiction, and it's something that for me hits home in coverage, is that we have to talk about perception and stigma. And so I always like to put it out in the room just to try and clear the air immediately that a large majority of us have been exposed to the medication that has led us to where we are today. Right. So I always think that's important.
Right. So it used to be, and prior to the opioid problem we are currently dealing with, people got their pathway to addiction to any drug started with alcohol and then marijuana. And there's a lot of coverage on sort of what we would call the pathway to addiction. And that's what I think she's referring to, is that prescription painkillers have become the new origin drug that leads others down, leads to that addiction pathway, and that drug comes from the legitimate medical community, and we're going to talk tonight about how that is different from other drug problems we've had and faced as a culture, and how it's also a reminder of something that also that happened at the turn of the 20th century and in the late 1900s. So let me clarify that the tolerance builds to drugs, and the tolerance that one builds from taking prescription opioids like Oxycontin and Percocet and things like that, if you don't take them, produce withdrawal. And then you take others, and as your tolerance builds, you have to take more of the same substance, or you have to take stronger potency opioids to ward off the withdrawal symptoms and to achieve the effects that those initial drugs did. That eventually, the building of tolerance and the prevention, the desire to prevent withdrawal symptoms, is what leads people down the path from relatively benign opioids that are prescribed to them to more dangerous, severe ones down the road. Well, I have a question for the audience before we get to how do we know what we know about a death a day in Delaware. What do you all know about the opioid problem here in Delaware, and where'd you get your information? Nothing? How many know something and they heard it from a friend or a family member, like a personal story, right? Absolutely. Of course. That's one common way we learn things from each other. And what we find is a lot of people have, as you said, have been impacted by the opioid epidemic. It's something that we're hearing a lot of. Another way is we read news reports that people like Brittany. How many people read the newspaper and have read something about the opioid problem in Delaware in the newspaper or some other media source, whether it's a government official speaking on television or, right. I'm going to ask a question, and I think we'll probably get the fewest number of hands. How many of you have learned something about the opioid problem from scientific research in peer-reviewed journals? Right. that's where our work tends to show up. And so what's really interesting for us to do is to talk about the different kinds of information that we get and to discuss the extent to which they complement each other. And the other way is are there instances where they contradict each other? So, you know, I have a history of doing research on several drug problems throughout the course of time. And what I'd like you to do is to think about, as I mention them, I'd like you to think about the traits and the characteristics of the people who are involved. And I want you to hold on to that, okay? So the first drug problem I studied as a young graduate student was the crack cocaine and powder cocaine problem of the 1980s. I was in graduate school. And I want you to think about the characteristics of crack cocaine addicts that perhaps were what do you know about crack cocaine addicts at the time? And then after that, I did study heroin injectors who were at risk for HIV infection on the west side of Chicago in the 1990s. And if you know anything about the west side of Chicago, it's a depressed socioeconomic area. And but those were heroin injectors back in the early 1990s, before the first wave of this epidemic took hold. From there, I studied a population that was receiving benefits, disability benefits, for drug abuse. And that was part of the welfare reform project of when Newt Gingrich, you know, was in control of Congress and we had the Welfare Reform Act. Those benefits were terminated. And you no longer can get disability benefits from our federal government for drug addiction and alcoholism. From there, I went on. I came to UD and I studied ravers, clubbers who were using club drugs. And think about the image of a raver and a clubber who was dancing all night to fast music. And then I'm now studying the drug problem. And I want you to think, what strikes you about how the faith of drug users has changed over time? Because I'm sort of struck by that as well. And how we talk about the people. Think about how we talk about it.
Well, and so Tammy and I had gone back and forth a little bit before this event, and I think she brings up a great point in talking about all that, and so I don't want to steal her thunder. But thinking about those people, I think it's really important to also consider, as a member of the media, how that's been portrayed as well then on our end. And we talk about it a lot, I think, now. And I think we're hearing a lot more conversation about it. But when we think back to while the cocaine epidemic was large, it was seen as a problem, right? So we talked about it as criminalization. We talked about the people using it. And we talked about a very large narrative that we kept hearing about how this was a bad drug, it was a dirty drug, and it needed to be criminalized. That has totally shifted now. And we're starting to see law enforcement talking about the war. I mean, one of the most quoted things I think I hear from police in Delaware right now is we lost the war on drugs. It didn't work. We now have a lot of people that are either incarcerated or getting out that serve time for a lot of minor drug offenses that really didn't do much good. And so now when we talk about the face, I think it's important because I will say it on the record. I think our media coverage, unfortunately, was very much slanted in a way that made people who use drugs out to be very bad people. And I think there's a much bigger conversation now about changing that. But I think we also have to talk about the fact the way our world looks at drugs now. In the last 10 to 20 years, we've actually started to identify addiction as a disease rather than a choice. We don't hear that as much anymore. We don't hear someone saying, well, you know, that's a bad choice that they made. No, we hear addiction being talked about as a disease. And we're actually seeing policy and leaders respond to it in that way. I think your point about faces is so important because in the back of your mind, and I will come back to this too, one of the joys that I have of doing my job is I get to tell a lot of those personal stories. But consider who, I mean, be stereotypical for a minute. Consider the face that you have in your mind right now when thinking about all of this.
Right.
And carry it with you through this conversation because I think it's an important part of what we're trying to get at.
I've had the privilege of using what we would call different techniques to study these different drug problems and the people impacted by them over the course of my career. And most of my time I spent as a street researcher. I went out and I talked and interviewed people. It's only recently where I've shifted into more statistical research and you know, documenting large trends. So I heard lots of stories. I mean, I gathered stories and worked in a clinic. That was our shop in Chicago. It was a clinic, a storefront on the west side. We brought heroin injectors in. We interviewed them. I heard the details of their life. I could see the impact of their drug use on them with their hands swollen from scars of injecting. And I think that they had many of the same problems that today's opioid misusers and addicts do too. But back then, we had a very criminalized viewpoint on them. Addiction was not yet a disease of the brain. And while I sometimes have to shake my head and go, oh, and not to be sort of regretful, that people from yesteryear who were suffering from addiction in many of the same ways that people today are, did not get the benefit of the doubt. I hope we never turn this page. I hope we never turn this page back to a criminalization focus, because these are people suffering from health problems, okay? And stigmatizing them for their problem is not going to help us as a society, and it's not really going to help them. So we are exactly where Brittany says we are today, a more humanitarian focus, a focus on public health, a push to get resources where they are. In the state of Delaware, there's lots of resources and initiatives happening right now with fantastic people out of the Lieutenant Governor's office, out of Department of Health and Social Services, private companies working to provide health treatments. And I really hope we never turn that page back, but we still have work to do to destigmatize this as a disease.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting when we talk about, I've thought a lot about, I mean, Tammy is coming at this from a very science perspective, and it was interesting. I went back to school this past year, got my master's degree, and one of the big conversations we had is how do we merge a lot of the great research that's being done and a lot of the great stories that are all a part of that data that Tammy is working with that I'm not necessarily dealing with, but I'm doing more on a case-by-case basis. And so part of my role, my background here in Delaware, I've been here for about 3.5 years now. About half a year into my time here, my editor at the time tasked me with explaining what the opioid epidemic was in Delaware. I do not purport to be any expert. I was very, very lucky to be a part of the National Press Foundation training that they did on opioids and what exactly was going on. And I've had the very large pleasure and benefit of getting to work with a lot of families and people who have been impacted by this on a very real level. And their stories are heart-wrenching and hopeful and all kinds of emotions. But what I will tell you is it's really interesting to think about what is getting people to engage in this conversation. Because what I would say to all of you is, you all have a reason to care. That's why you're here, right?
Right.
You came tonight because this matters to you for whatever personal reason that may be. But my job as a journalist is to try and figure out how do I engage the larger population in talking about this, in understanding it, in wanting to have a conversation about what, frankly, is not a very uplifting topic most of the time. What I've learned is that personal stories matter. If I can tell you about a real person and a real name and a real face, it is going to sink in a lot more. What that can get from the science aspect of criticism is that I use one story as a case study, which by default, one person is not going to be the experience of everyone else. But I would say that I think in Delaware, as Tammy mentioned, there is a lot of work being done, and that can't be ignored. The state of the heroin epidemic and the opioid epidemic here is bad. I mean, we titled it a death a day for this presentation because that's what we're on pace to lose this year. That is what the numbers thus far for this year have shown. And interestingly enough, when we talk about faces, it's not just one face. So whatever vision you have in your head, I can promise you I've talked to someone that doesn't fit it. That has a totally different story, that might break the anomaly, that might break the pattern that we see. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with those patterns. But all I ask is that as a journalist, but also as a human being who has gone out and interviewed a lot of different people, don't let that face that you might have be the face that you expect or be the only face that you're willing to accept. Because we're going to share, I think, a lot of different things that we've seen over the years. But what I will tell you is there are a ton of people affected by this in Delaware. And a lot of their stories look the same, but a lot of their stories look very different. And I think it's really important whenever we talk about this to honor those individual stories and to recognize that your experience might not be someone else's, and that does not make it any less valuable.
So how is, one of the things that we talked about is discussing how the current opioid epidemic is different from ones we've had previously. And I can think of a couple reasons. I'm sure that you all, and please feel free to comment and ask questions. One is death, okay? That this is what death and the death rate is something that makes the current opioid epidemic so different. We have not seen this amount of deaths from a prior drug epidemic in the course of history. I think the only thing that might have come close, some research suggests, was the gun violence that characterized the crack cocaine epidemic. But I do think that overdose deaths will probably surpass that. As you know, it is overdose deaths are the number one non-accidental?
Leading cause of death.
Right, having surpassed traffic fatalities. If you take a look at the numbers in Delaware, and we're going to show you a map here, but in 2013, think of what you were doing in 2013, the state of Delaware had about 189 overdose deaths. By 2017, there were closer to 350. So over a period of time in this small state, they more than doubled and were on pace, as Brittany said, to surpass that number this year. So death is one of the differences about this epidemic, and that's what makes one of the things that makes this epidemic so tragic. And that is rightful that we pay attention to that, but there's some other important markers of this opioid epidemic that we can't take our eye off of. Lost workplace productivity. We have dangerous numbers out of the Council of Economic Advisors that show people are dropping out of work at rates we haven't seen before because of opioid misuse disorder. We have babies being born to suffering from neonatal abstinence syndrome, okay? That's another complication. The opioid epidemic is guesstimated to cost us more than $1 trillion per year, and people say that is a conservative estimate. So while we're all, of course, focused on death as the ultimate consequence, there are other markers of this opioid epidemic consequences we've traditionally paid attention to that aren't getting as much discussion.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. In the fall, this past fall, the News Journal actually sponsored a What Heroin Costs Delaware. And we tried to actually, for the first time, really break down the cost of this heroin and opioid epidemic on the state. The kicker that I hate to tell all of you, no one really knows. And yep. I hate to say this, but the state is not actively tracking it. And they were pretty blunt about it because we reached out to law enforcement. We reached out to EMS. And people could give you bits and pieces. They could tell you how much naloxone costs. They could tell you what an ambulance ride may cost. But on this larger value, and something that the council, actually, financial advisors, they put out that report just before we published the story, so it was great timing for me. For the first time, people are actually trying to figure out what the loss of a life would cost. And I say that with an asterisk because, obviously, there is no way to put a cost on the life of a person. But what these council of financial advisors tried to do is determine what is the value they would have added to the world financially, in the workplace, in all of these different avenues that we don't think about. But Tammy's right. There are dozens of babies born exposed to drugs, specifically opioids and heroin. And unfortunately, a lot of the research is that we don't really know what those effects are going to be on children down the line. There's some preliminary stuff, but it's still pretty new. The other thing that I would add to it, and not just the hospital costs that we're talking about, but where do these moms with their children go? Sober living facilities are a big thing, and I'm sure if any of you have turned an ear to kind of the larger conversation, we talk about treatment availability here in Delaware and what's available to people who want to get help and need it. One of the biggest issues is for women and children. Where do those women go, and where do they go that they can take their children with them? Because I hate to tell you this, the foster system is wrecked right now by the opioid epidemic, largely because we're seeing grandparents turn into caregivers. We are seeing people that are in a much different phase of their life being asked to take care of very small children. And sometimes, I mean, in great scenarios, we're seeing the parents get help. In the worst scenarios, we're seeing them die. Yeah. It happens. It happens every single day. And I think that's a great point, though, that this cost idea, which as much as it's very frustrating, I will tell you, society gets. Because the minute you say taxpayer dollars are going somewhere you don't want it to go, everyone sits up. Right. So it is. It's an interesting part of this, but it's something, unfortunately, I don't think our country has a very good grasp on yet, just what this long-term cost loss is going to be.
Good.
Another thing I think is different about the current opioid epidemic than the ones that I've been researching, like the crack cocaine epidemic, the rave phenomena, and I didn't even mention the methamphetamine problem of the 80s and 90s, is this one began, as Brittany said, and this tacks into what the two men's questions were. This one began in doctor's offices. You know, it began with the legitimate pharmaceutical industry. And I had my class, I'm teaching a class right now on the opioid epidemic, and I had my class work with me to produce a timeline for the origins. And sir, this gets a little bit back to what you were asking about earlier. And so if you take a look at some of these factors that just converge like a perfect storm, right? So you had OxyContin come out on the market in 1996, and it was marketed as an addiction-proof drug. And, you know, Purdue Pharma went across the country, they talked to doctors, they invited them to resorts for educational seminars, and they used a few, I think two studies, that one was a paragraph long in the New England Journal of Medicine, and the Porter and Jick paper, and they used that to justify saying that addiction is a result in a very, very small number of cases. And about at the same time that Purdue Pharma was, you know, debuting this product that they convinced the medical community would have little risk of addiction, pain got deemed the fifth vital sign. Right? And you and I have a right to be relieved from pain from our medical doctors. And doctors have an obligation to treat our pain. Rise of the pain clinics, right? Rise of treating pain at the same time. Well, you know anything about drug, just those two factors, and we come together with a timeline of more, put so many opioids in the hands of people were going home. At the beginning, there were pill mills too, and the pill mills were allowed to dispense drugs. It's not as though you got your prescription from a doctor and had to go to a pharmacy. At pill mills, you could pick them up. And the basic prescription, if you read Dreamland, if you read American Pain, which are great books, by the way, people were getting, as a prescription, 350 Oxy-40s and 180 benzodiazepines, okay, at their first appointment. Nobody takes that many pills. They were assuming they would take about 8 of them a day. What ended up happening is those pills were sold and diverted. People earned money by selling them. They came from Kentucky to Florida. They went from West Virginia to Florida, and they picked them up there. Or they used them, and sir, they developed tolerance to them. They developed tolerance to taking, having that big surplus of pills, and they then transitioned to higher, more potent doses, leading them. That's why we have the opioid epidemics in three waves. We're in wave three now. We're in the first wave was prescription opioid death. The second wave was both heroin and fentanyl. We're now in the third wave, which started at about 2013 and is raging on right now. And most of the deaths are dominated by fentanyl, which is a much more potent opioid that is extremely dangerous. Is there a question? Oh, so you can do the mic thing. So that's another. But the gentleman in the white shirt who asked the question earlier, you know, when Brittany first started tonight, she had you raise your hand if you had an opioid prescription. And a lot of you put your hand up, but I bet very few of you have an opioid problem. Right? So is that the other way to look at what you're talking about? Yeah. So I had this conversation with a guy I was on a flight with, and you know, I was busy going over a paper, right, that I was working on. I know, don't sit beside me when I when I fly. I was working on a paper, and he said, I'm sorry, but I'm looking over your head, and I see that you're writing about the opioid problem, and you know, I'm interested in this topic. And I talked to him. He had, you know, a knee replacement, and he had a back problem, and he was prescribed lots of painkillers, and he just couldn't wrap his head around why some people develop addiction to them and others don't. And there are some questions that we haven't answered yet. We have to answer. What distinguishes somebody like the people in this audience today who can take opioid painkillers, right, and who have a right to be relieved from their suffering? They don't want to take Advil, you know, or, you know, an SAID, Tylenol or something like that for their pain. Why do we want to penalize all of them because of the risk of addiction? How do we balance that? You know, and I'm a researcher. The best I do is pass my findings on to people like, state practitioner policymakers, all right? And the policymakers pay attention to what Brittany writes as well. But they have the ominous job of solving the problem. Yeah. And they have the ominous job of deciding what laws to pass. And if they pass a law, Delaware legislator, constraining prescriptions for acute conditions to 7 days, there is going to be people who don't get the medication they think they need and feel like they're being penalized unfairly. It's a solving the problem, yeah, is difficult. Characterizing the problem and we're like the beginning of the problem solving, right? But actually implementing the solutions, allocating the resources for it, becomes really challenging.
Well, and it's also very worth pointing out. A lot of people talk about, well, why make the transition? And a lot of people will say, you know, why heroin? I mean, who really wants to use a needle and shoot something into your arm? I can raise my right hand to God and tell you right now, I have not interviewed one single person who ever looked at me and said, yeah, I woke up one day and I wanted to become addicted to drugs. There is something about brain chemistry. There is something about, I mean, I'm sure many of you in this room, if you are here tonight, have heard that there are talks about genes that leave you you all know what I'm trying to say, to addiction. It's been a long day. That there are different factors, that your brain chemistry changes. I mean, there are lots and lots of different theories, and there's lots of things that are still being researched by wonderful people like Tammy, and that is so, so important. But we all want answers now, right? I would love to wake up tomorrow and say, I don't need to write one more story about addiction other than the fact that we figured it out and we solved it. I would love to not sit down with another family member and have to walk through the struggle that they have been through. I would kill to do that. But it's important to think about this. A pill on the street is about $20 to $25. For a nice Vicodin, the Percocet, you name it, heroin's $5 a bag. Uh-huh. That is like cheaper than a good beer at a bar. Really? I mean, to think about that in perspective. I know we're near UD, so maybe beer prices are cheap around here. But, really, I mean...
drink at UD.
Oh, that's right. Never mind. Didn't you guys just get made one number one party school?
Yes,
yeah,
we did. We certainly did.
I mean, hey, I did go to Penn State, so I took a little issue with it. But, no, I mean, I do think it's important to think about on a personal level. I mean, I have a younger brother who had knee surgery. This was 8 years ago. They sent him home with 100 Percocet. I think, and I really mean this, I mean, I think as journalists it's important to acknowledge too, it is personal. It's personal for everyone. For anyone that says it's not, I would question their line of reasoning here. I think every day, I am so happy my younger brother did not have that reaction, did not have that feeling where, wow, I love how this feels. I've had oral surgery. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have had opioids prescribed for anything related to, like, dentist work?
Right.
I mean, I had it 3 years ago, and I told the doctor as I was coming out of anesthesia, he's like, I'm going to give you more Vicodin. I said, no, I don't want any. You're contributing to the opioid epidemic. I don't want any. I proceeded to have a very serious conversation with him once I was, like, cognizant with it. But I think it's important to consider that, like, this is not a moral failing of people for having this reaction to it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, really, I cannot stress enough, I've never talked to someone who has wanted to be in that position. About 2 years ago, we did a series on medication-assisted treatment. So this idea of giving people medication to help them either stave off cravings, to deal with withdrawal, and to manage their addiction, to kind of keep them at a baseline. And I was down at Connections in Millsboro, and I was sitting in a room, and one of the public information people, we got permission to talk to a couple people, and he said, oh, I'm going to bring someone back. And this woman walked in. And I kid you not, she sat down in front of me, and I'm like, do you have the wrong room? She was maybe this tall, had on a floral dress, sneakers like my grandma wears, probably my grandma's age. And I looked at her and I said, are you in the right place? And she said, yeah. I am in recovery for addiction to opioid painkillers. And I will never forget her name. Donna and I had a great conversation. Her doctor, she needed knee replacements, and her doctor said, you're kind of young for it. Let's hold off. Let's give you opioids instead. Let's treat your pain. We don't want to keep you in pain. She became addicted. She ended up losing her family. She lost her house. She spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on these pain pills. And she never touched heroin. She never touched heroin because she financially was able to never touch heroin. And she was very clear about that.
So that's
a real thing.
That tragic case is common.
Yeah.
Right? And it blends with one of the things I wanted to make sure to mention tonight, and that is, while it is true anybody can become addicted to opioid painkillers, there are some clear demographic patterns. And it helps us if we understand who is impacted and where. And we're going to show you a map here shortly, a sub-project that I'm working on that will be, as of tonight, it is public. We launched the project publicly. This is a public website, and I'm going to give shout-outs to my fellow CDHS colleagues for bringing this to light. But I'm worried about white men. I'm worried about white men this time. I mean, there's always a population, there's always a demographic that stands out. And this time, it is white males. There is something about males that will transition to illegal drugs at rates that women don't. And so what we saw at the beginning of this epidemic was the historical, perhaps, reversal of a trend in overdose deaths, that women were going to catch up to men. In previous opioid epidemics, drug epidemics, there was a big gap between males and females. And then the first wave happened, and women started to OD at higher rates. But now that the epidemic has shifted to heroin and fentanyl, that gap has reemerged. And women just do not transition to illegal drugs at the same rate that men do, and we now have a more familiar gender gap. And who is dropping out of the workforce? Males. Males are hit hardest by loss productivity. It's time for us to pay attention to some of these patterns. Yes, all of us can be impacted, but if there are certain groups that are more at risk, isn't it our job to address the special needs? There's not one size that'll fit all here. There really isn't.
No, I mean, to go back, think about the face that you have envisioned in your head. Anyone mind sharing what the image they have? I'm sorry, I'm jumping
in the back.
Mic.
Right,
sorry.
Eva. From the opioid epidemic. Right. And so by lumberjack, is that somebody situated in the country, in a rural setting?
Most of the time, yeah.
Most of the time in the rural. So how many of you think the opioid problem is the worst in rural areas? The country. Oh, only a few of you. Okay. Right. Well, let's take a look. Should we take a look
sure.
in Delaware?
Yeah.
Logan? Let's take a look. So this is, I'm going to move out of the way here. This is our project, the Delaware Opioid Metric Intelligence Project. It's funded by the National Institute of Justice. And this is an interactive mapping program that will give you information on markers of the opioid problem here in Delaware. And what you see there is currently the state of Delaware divvied up into about 214 neighborhoods. We call them, technically they're called census tracts. And the area, the map is shaded with hot spots. And the idea is that the redder it is, the higher the overdose rate is. So visually it provides a nice way to look at the distribution of overdose death hotspots in the state of Delaware. Now, if you click back to 2013, Logan, you can see there were far fewer hotspots, right? And then go to 2014, they begin to grow. Go to 2015, they shift a little bit. But they are. And then 16. And notice what's happening in the southern part of the state. Okay? See what's happening in the southern part of the state? And keep in mind, the neighborhood boundaries in the northern part of the state are smaller, so they visually may not look comparable, but they're based on population. Okay? And we all know population concentration is highest in New Castle County because of the city of Wilmington. And then go back to 2017. In Delaware, for this time period, the highest rates of overdose death are still concentrated in our urban areas, even though Seaford and Sussex County are suffering problems as well. And so you can what you'll be able to do with this is you'll be able to sort it by zip code. And so you can turn the map on, and now you can see it by zip code. You can also see it by house district, but you don't have to do that quite yet. But if you go back to the census tract map of 2017, the other thing we've done here is we've loaded where the methadone clinics and the residential treatment facilities are in the state, okay? And if you click on any one of the little neighborhoods there, Logan, can you give us an example? Okay, and you can certainly zoom in. If you click on any one of them, you get this little pop-up. And you get the name of the neighborhood, and then you can get the risk factors, the overdose death rate. And this neighborhood is very interesting because the tracked OD death rate is 81 per 100,000 population, but the opioid death rate is half that. What does that mean? People are dying, overdosing from drugs other than opioids. In some of the neighborhoods, they're one and the same. The opioid death rate and the total overdose death rate are exactly the same rate. So this is really good information because it suggests that, like other drug problems, okay, this, we hope, will peak and decline, but there's usually always another drug problem historically that comes behind it, and perhaps this can, something like this surveillance data can help us anticipate what's next and where it might be. So I encourage you to go to our web link, find your neighborhood, and take a look at the information over time.